Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, we're at it again. Hi, this is your host, Cliff Dunning, and welcome to Earth Ancients. Yes, and they are startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. That's what we're all about. We are bringing you information on history, known and unknown. And I'm really looking at the unknown because the unknown seems to be more fascinating. We're at a Saturday today. It's the last day of August, and we're into the Labor Day weekend for those of you who are in the United States. So it's a long weekend, and it looks like we have quite a few people listening in today. I have been posting quite a bit of information on the Facebook page, which is the great reference point here for a lot of the guests that we have on our podcast. And I brought up a series of photos that I had posted earlier in the year, and the title is Lost Technological Past of Ancient Central America. Now, about a decade ago, archaeologists uncovered the ruins of El Mirador in Guatemala. And among the discoveries was a fascinating sculptural relief of what appeared to be an individual in a spacesuit. Now, the archaeologists were quick to remind people that this was probably one of the brothers from the Popol Vuh, the famous Maya book of the ancients. But what they forgot to tell us is that that book was written closer to the classic period, maybe 1,000 or less years ago. And El Mirador has recently been dated to probably 1800 BC rather than well, the point I'm trying to make is the Popol Vuh came out later, and this figure they suspect was carved very, very, very early. So that kind of throws that out the window, the Popol Vuh connection. And the big issue around it for me is what he has on. What is this character wearing in El Mirador? And they found him in a civic center in an area around one of the main temples. And what he is wearing appears to be, and it looks like, a helmet with zero gravity clothing, including gloves and full body wear. And on his back, all indications are he's wearing a jetpack. Now, why would I say a jetpack and not like a weight or something else? Well, there's actual exhaust or an emission coming out of the back of this figure, this jetpack. So the people who say, well, that he's underwater, he's swimming underwater, doesn't really fly because this is an actual emission from the jetpack. I put a comparison piece below that was found in Calcatzingo, which is in northern Highland Mexico, and that group is considered to be related to the Olmec of Central America. The figure below the El Mirador figure is almost in the same position, as if floating in space. He has a helmet on, very similar to the other character in Guatemala. And in his hand, there seems to be some kind of device that is projected forward. So the question I have for all of you is, what do you think it is? My belief is it's from a very advanced civilization, proto-Maya, or people who actually were before the Maya, and who this is kind of a historic memory, or my guess is that there was probably some reference in the form of equipment that was saved and cherished, and this is an actual character that was from a story or a manual or a historical past that we have no reference to. Now, remember, when the Spanish came and conquered the Maya and the Aztec and the other native people, they literally burned complete libraries of references and codices, which are the bark books that are folding, and all understanding that we have of their past. So, and we've heard from various people who have studied the Maya that they have heard, in specific, the engineer Ocon, who described his interactions with a number of native elders who have stories of the Spanish literally throwing piles of volumes of codices and other manuals into the flames. So any reference to the ancient past is gone. All we have are the artworks, the sculptural reliefs, and hopefully one day someone will uncover a library or some more manuals, some codices that have more information. Because the Maya are very, very sophisticated, extremely sophisticated. So take a look at that. Also, one of our one of the members did a highlight of the Mirador figure and actually shows the technology that is attached to the figure who's floating in space. And when I say highlights, he's actually outlined and colorized the equipment, the helmet, as it is attached to a breathing system, which is also attached to this jetpack. It's quite interesting. So take a look at that. One other thing I'm going to mention real quickly before we bring on our guest here is Andrew Collins continues to send photographs of the Göbekli Tepe, but not only that, he's also sent photographs of Karahan Tepe, which is a few miles from Göbekli Tepe. And the photograph that I posted earlier in the week is of a megalith as it stands. It's probably about ready to be cut free, but it was left in this quarry. And the stone is perfectly cut. It's a T-shaped megalith that is quite well known at Göbekli Tepe. But this is a great example of how they actually carved the stone. It's heavy T-top, and then it's kind of streamlined down to a base. What we don't know is how it was moved from this location to the actual civic area where it was laid in position. Excuse me. And how it was set in position, how it was finished, and things like that, we can only guess. So the estimated date on this megalith is probably 10,000 years or older, based on the place that it was put into place to create the civic area. Take a look at that, and also scroll through. You'll see information on Göbekli Tepe. Of course, our guest next week is Andrew Collins, and we'll talk to him more about that. But today we're talking about China. China has been a fascination of mine since I can remember. I was introduced to China by my grandfather, who was kind of a worldly character, a physician in Central California, who collected Chinese historical items, and the house was filled with it. So I was always interested in Chinese culture. Our guest today is Laird Scranton, and he has written a book called China's Cosmological Prehistory, The Sophisticated Science Encoded in Civilization's Earliest Symbols. Laird is an independent software designer who has studied ancient myth, language, and cosmology for more than a decade. An authority on Dagon mythology and symbolism, he is the author of The Science of Dagon, Sacred Symbols of the Dagon, Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol, and the Velikovsky Heresies. He lives in Albany, New York. I am looking forward to this, and I'd like to welcome you to the program, Laird. How are you today?
I'm good, Cliff. Thanks a lot for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
I'm looking forward to hearing all about this new book that you have out. Now, I'm discussing this book. Now, it's not going to be out for a few more months, but
It's out this week.
Wonderful! So this is actually good.
Right.
Oh, perfect.
So,
perfect.
I received copies earlier this week, and it's officially available now.
Oh, fantastic! You've done a tremendous amount of research and study on the, is it the Dogon or Dagon people? How do I pronounce?
Dogon.
Okay. Okay. Very good. They were located in Africa. What led you to China after so much research on people of Africa? I mean, simply put, what is the connection? What would take you from Africa to China?
Okay, well, what I do is I'm my field of study is called comparative cosmology. What that means is that I look at the myths and symbols and rituals of various cultures that have similar traditions and compare one to another, trying to learn more about them. This is sort of the same process that scholars used when they were trying to compare variant versions of Shakespeare's plays to come up with a definitive version of what the original must have looked like. Well, there are a lot of commonalities in these ancient traditions, and it occurred to me that if we could compare one to the other, we could settle on a set of references that were common to all of them, and that must represent what the original tradition looked like. So I started with this little African tribe. It's a modern-day tribe called the Dogon in Mali, which is in the hump of northwest Africa. And they're a good place to start because they represent kind of a crossroads for ancient traditions. They have certain aspects of their culture that are like ancient Egypt, and others that are like Judaism, and others that are like Buddhism. And so having this all in place in one culture looked like an opportunity to me.
Okay.
So my series of books basically work forward from that. They start with what the Dogon priests tell us. Now, these modern-day priests retain a very clear sense of what their symbols and their myths mean, and they can explain them in modern terms. And there were a pair of French anthropologists who studied them for about 30 years and documented what their tradition was about. And I use that as a starting point, that and a Dogon dictionary. And so people like Carl Jung noticed that in widespread cultures around the world, you've got a lot of similarity in these ancient myths and symbols. He tried to explain it psychologically by saying that effectively that we're wired to see concepts of creation in certain ways, and there may be such a thing as a collective unconscious where we are all effectively linked to a common server, where we perceive certain things in common ways.
Mm-hmm.
My outlook on it is a little
okay.
bit different, because in the traditions I study, when you get down to the bottom of the tradition, they're all telling us the same thing. They're all saying that someone who knew a lot more about science and creational science, basically, than they did, taught them these things and gave them these symbols that represent certain things.
Hmm.
So, working from those overt statements on the part of the Buddhists and the Dogon and people in ancient Egypt and so forth, I've been trying to trace things back.
Okay.
My progression has been from Africa to Egypt to India to Tibet and now on to China. And basically what I've done is in the first three books I ended up developing a set of what I called signature signs of this tradition. And I mean certain practices and symbols and symbolic meanings that if you find it in a culture is a good indicator that they had the same tradition. And I noticed that ancient China had a number of these signature signs, which said to me that it was going to be worth my while to write a book about it.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let me ask you, I have to ask you this question. Do you feel that people like Robert Temple in his book, The Serious Mystery, is correct that these cultures really got their information from off-world beings, or do you think it was which many of us in the alternative research arena believe was Earth-derived from very old, early Earth cultures who, through their own process of R&D and research and whatever, came up and developed high levels of sophisticated society?
Okay, that's a tough question. One of my criteria for making an interpretation is, in order to protect myself from the tendency of people, myself included, to come up with wishful interpretations, to subconsciously expect a certain outcome, and so now we see things that support that outcome. So the way to protect mm-hmm. against that is to make sure that every interpretation is based on an explicit statement on the part of the cultures I'm studying, and that it be confirmed mm-hmm. either by another culture that has the same tradition, or it's got to be restated in multiple ways within the first culture. So then you know you're on firm ground. You can say, this culture believed this. I'm now pursuing this thought that this culture had, and it's not something that I just made up out of my head. So the Buddhists flatly say that their tradition rests on symbols that that they feel were given to them by a non-human source. The Dogon say mm-hmm. that they feel that their tradition was given to them by a group that they consider to be a non-human source. They go a step further. The Dogon describe this non-human source as being not off-world in nature, but spiritual in nature. They see, as a lot of the other traditions I study see, an interlink between a material universe and a non-material universe. And the non-material universe supposedly, ostensibly, has perfect knowledge, but an inability to act. And the material universe has a perfect ability to act, but imperfect knowledge. And it's a cooperative effort between these two aspects of the universe, if you look at it that way, that produced this knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but effectively, what it boils down to is someone who knew more than we do created a system of symbols and rituals that were meant to communicate certain information to us.
Right, and that's the point of your book, is the parallels between Egyptian hieroglyphs, Chinese symbology, India, and some of the other ancient cultures. So I guess I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but I'm just curious as to what you personally feel, and maybe you don't want to give us that perspective. You'd rather say that I only want to present the material that is in written form that is known without giving a hypothesis of where this data, this information may have originated. As an example, the Maya come complete with an advanced science, mathematics, medicine, among other things, out of nowhere. My feeling and the feeling that I have learned from the traditions of the elders who are left to us is that they received their information from a much earlier culture who had gone through and developed their civilization to a high degree. I don't use the term Atlantis. I don't even use the term I strongly disagree with anything having to do with ancient aliens, which is very in vogue right now. But I do take the traditions that are presented by the Maya as and the mythologies as kind of a reference point for their science. What do you have to say about the Chinese, the ancient Chinese, the symbology in their science? As an example, can you give us an idea of some science that's encoded in their symbology?
Sure. The tradition that I'm pursuing is fundamentally similar at bottom in every one of the cultures that I'm studying. So talking about China is no different than talking about Egypt or Africa or India, as far as I'm concerned. At bottom, it's the same. But there are two considerations here. There's a consideration of what happened since the end of the Ice Age. It looks like at the end of the Ice Age that there was major catastrophe in terms of civilization, and that there was a recovery period afterwards. And that recovery period is where this system of symbols comes from. However, there are also indications in these cultures I study that there had been, that this was a pulling up by the bootstraps the first time of humanity to a civilized state. It was a restoration of civilization to humanity. In other words, there are hints that this was not the first time that humanity had seen civilization, and that points to things that happened before the Ice Age. Those things before the Ice Age, I can't make any absolute statements about, except to say that the cultures I study, many of them have references that look like they tie back to cultures before the Ice Age. However, mm-hmm. the specific tradition I'm chasing looks like a system that was evolved after the Ice Age, and according to the groups that I am studying, that system was developed by not by ancient humans, but by a kind of Peace Corps effort that was raised after the Ice Age to help us back on our feet.
Hmm. So would you say that was a unified kind of a goal, where whoever was survived the Ice Age as a collection or a collective made an attempt to kickstart civilization again? That's fascinating.
Yes, yes. The Dogon flatly say it, and many of the other cultures do also. What they describe, okay, there was a concern. The Dogon are telling us that the instructors of this tradition were not material in nature; they were non-material, and there was a concern that of what the long-term effects might be of contact between us and them, not of us hurting them, but of them hurting us. And so their solution to that problem was to sequester a group of people from each region at some remote site, instruct 8 members of a tribe in various skills of civilization, send those 8 back to their original culture, and have them instruct their cohort. And so the basic scheme here is that they established high mountaintop sanctuaries like Göbekli Tepe, where skills were taught, and that after those skills were mastered, then those people went back and represented the mythical 8 teachers that you see discussed in culture after culture, the 8 sages of China, and there's always this set of 8 ancestral gods or ancestral teachers who come in and are related to skills of civilization. So in China,
wow.
You have the same tradition, but we have a difficulty in China that we don't have elsewhere. Okay, in ancient Egypt, we have a long history from the very big onset of writing around 3000 BC of written texts that we have samples of that we've recovered as artifacts that we can look at and point to and firmly state, here's what the Egyptians said about such and such. In China, the situation is different because events that happened at 3000 BC, our earliest artifact in writing dates to around 300 BC. So you've got this enormous gap between when the thing happened and when it was written down. And because of that, you've got all this academic infighting in China as to, you know, if I say A, three other academics say B, C, and D. So nothing is carved in stone, so to speak, in China because nobody can get a firm grip on what anything means. Now, my situation is a little different because the way this system of cosmology, which was also a civilizing plan, was configured, every concept in the system is given with multiple meanings. To give you an example, the Dogon hidden god, his name Amma, also means to grasp or to hold firm or to establish. And so you've got two meanings here that are not connected to one another logically. You can't get to one from the other by knowing the other. You go to Egypt, you've got a god Amen, who was a hidden god, whose name means to grasp or hold firm or establish. So now, what I've done over 20 years is correlated these terms between cultures based on those multiple meanings. And those meanings don't float with the pronunciation, they float with the concept. So you can go, in the case of the Dogon, all the Dogon words look to be ancient Egyptian words, and so those were fairly easy to correlate. When you go to India, the words are given in Sanskrit, which is an entirely different language. However, the concepts still hold their groupings. So when you find the Sanskrit word that means to grasp, hold firm, and establish, that also means hidden, you know you've got a lock on a match.
Ah, very good.
So what I did was I took sources that were careful to describe the various meanings of ancient Chinese words, and I started correlating those to what is given in the Dogon Dictionary and the Egyptian Dictionary and so forth. And so now I can take a term that the Chinese scholars are uncertain what it really meant, and I can look at the Dogon, what the Dogon and the Egyptians have to say about the term, and infer what it must have meant. And so that's part of what I'm doing in this book is, a large part of what I'm doing in this book is reviewing the various aspects of ancient Chinese cosmology that are known, and the words and terms and concepts that relate to the myths and symbols, and showing how those tie to Egyptian and Dogon and Buddhist concepts.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Chinese cosmology. In the book, you describe Taoist cosmology. What makes that a unique approach?
Okay. Taoism was one of the traditions in ancient China. It wasn't the earliest tradition, but it was one of the traditions, and it is inherently has some inherent cosmology to it. The Taoists said that they were describing stages of creation, and in the Dogon system, there are very clear definitions of the stages of creation. So clear, not only are they clear, but they're also scientific. In my first book, what I did basically was lay statements and drawings that the Dogon make side by side with statements and diagrams from Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene and people like that to demonstrate an intuitive match between the stages of creation of matter that the Dogon describe and the stages that science understands. The system is inherently scientific. So in Taoism, this system of creation, when we talk about matter, involves the formation of a little, the Dogon call it an egg, at every little point in space and time. In string theory, it's called the Calabi-Yau space, and it's a little bundle of eight wrapped-up dimensions that were too insubstantial to hold their own weight, and so they collapsed. So in Taoism, when they describe eight stages of creation, the fact that they're talking about creation and the fact that they give it in terms of eight stages is a tip-off to me that they're talking about creation of matter. So now I can begin looking at the words and terms and concepts that the Chinese use to describe Taoist philosophy and correlate them back to these eight stages as they're given in other cultures. And then I can write a chapter that says, here's what the Taoists were talking about.
And does Western science consider Taoist cosmology at all when they describe the Big Bang Theory and things like that?
There are some astrophysicists who I think are convinced that there is legitimate information in the Vedic tradition and places like that. But most traditionally, most scientists have looked at these ancient traditions as if they were fairy tales. And so it'd be like trying to compare a serious scientific study they were doing with Hansel and Gretel.
Well, let me ask you, this is one of my big problems, is that orthodox science fails to look at traditions that have been on the earth for thousands of years. What is your feeling by them overlooking the Taoist cosmology or any of the Chinese or other ancient cultures that you've studied? What do you think is the effect of that? Or is there an effect?
Well, okay, there's a metaphor I use. Imagine that I was the only person on the planet who understood that Twinkies exist. I couldn't convince anybody that Twinkies actually exist. My outlook on that is, so what? I've still got Twinkies. It doesn't depend. My enjoying a Twinkie doesn't depend on somebody else understanding that they exist. And that's the way it is with these traditions, that I'm trying to do a careful job of documenting what I see in these traditions. And it really doesn't matter to me whether a traditional scientist agrees with that or not, because I'm making headway and progress, as are there's an entire community of researchers that include Andrew Collins and people like that, who are making tangible headway towards understanding these ancient sites and ancient references. And it makes no difference any longer whether a traditional researcher accepts it or acknowledges it. We have our own thread going here.
So your feeling is that even though orthodox science doesn't really consider the material from these ancient cultures as a valid point of reference, you feel that you don't care, that
I care to the extent that I want to do a careful job of researching what I'm looking at. I want to do a job that basically, for me, any interpretation, for me to say that it's a correct interpretation, I have to be able to reduce fractions and finish a simple sentence. And the sentence is, we know this must be true because, and then finish the sentence. If I can do that,
but if you were,
I'm on firm ground with my interpretation, and I'll show it to a scientist, and they can do whatever they want.
I just have to say this one thing. If you found the key to understanding how the atom works in such a degree as how it may how we may influence it with our thoughts in the dialogues, in the manuscripts, and it was a big revelation, wouldn't you want people to know about that on a larger scale?
That's not really a theoretic question for me, that in the Dogen system of cosmology, there are details there that go beyond what astrophysicists understand right now. For example, the Dogen will talk about the process by which a mere act of perception can cause a wave to turn into a particle, and I don't know of any astrophysicist who's addressed that.
Wow.
There are lots of details here that if a serious astrophysicist would pay attention to them, I think could save them 50 years. But
wow.
I also know that it's a fool's errand to try to convince them of that.
And there's nobody that has read any of your work that says you got something here?
No, yes, there are. There's a well-known astrophysicist, or a well-known physicist, who has worked on governmental projects and has founded a couple of companies that are involved with creation of anti-gravity devices, who has carefully reviewed the first couple of books that I wrote, and his response to them was, whoever put this information together in the original ancient system knew what they were talking about. And not only did they know what they were talking about, it represents a specific version of string theory called torsion theory.
Wow. Well, that must have been gratifying to hear someone say that about your work.
It was. Actually, he said that he had been waiting for 20 years for someone to come along and tell him that the ancient traditions represented that. So he had his suspicions, but he didn't have any foothold into how to show that it was true. And so it was sort of mutually gratifying to have found that.
Wow. Let's talk about these ancient beings, these ancestors that the Chinese revere so much. In your book, I think it's chapter 3, you have a title. It's titled Ancestor Teachers in Chinese Cosmology. Can you describe these ancestor teachers, these beings
we'll start with the Dogon perspective. From the Dogon perspective, as in a lot of cultures, these are sort of quasi-mythical beings who are credited with having brought skills of civilization to humanity in the context of a creation tradition. Okay, they were also the founders of 8 lineages that compare to the lineages in Judaism, the Levi and the priestly clan in Judaism. They're called the Hogan and for the Dogon. These families.
You're not talking about the Essenes, are you?
No, I'm talking about the. Let's see. I'm trying to think of what the correct term is.
Well, we'll move along and we'll pick it up. Go ahead.
Right. Okay. Anyway, there are these traditional family lineages that are really descend from. They define different types of priesthood. Up to my fact checker is coming here. They're the Kohanes. My wife serves as my fact checker. She's always on.
Reach out and say thank you.
Yeah, well, I do have to thank her. Yeah, but she won't let me get away with anything. If I say something that's incorrect, you know, she's on it. So the Kohen and the Levites in Judaism are sort of surviving remnants of these 8 families that the Dogon describe, or something akin to these 8 families. Now, in ancient China, you have a tradition that there were 8 ancestor teachers or ancestor gods. The problem is that the evidence is so sketchy in China that none of the academics can agree on who the 8 were. They all agree on who the candidates are, but they can't agree on a set of 8. And so, again, things are sort of cast in mud. And so in my book, I try to discuss the most likely candidates for those positions and discuss what sorts of things they do and how that ties back to the traditions I can more firmly anchor. But in China, there's no way, nothing can be said absolutely from an academic point of view about cosmology in China. Now, one thing I've learned over time is that the farther back in time we go, the more commonality of language we tend to find. And I've also learned that the significant words in a language, typically the words of cosmology, the words of religion, the words that are foundational to a society, tend to stay in those languages for very long periods of time. Linguists call these ultra-conserved words. And so you can go to a modern version of the Turkish language, say, and look for how certain these words were pronounced and what their meanings were, and come up with an approximation of what the ancient term was. And same thing is true in China, that the terms that are being discussed by the academics, even when they don't know for certain what the term meant, still reflect the right pronunciation and the right basic meanings to get me back to the words I understand.
Okay.
So the ancestors were a series of quasi-mythical emperors and sages who the Chinese scholars are uncertain very often whether they were historical or mythical or a little of both. The sages were credited with having accomplished certain things, had certain attributes, and done certain things. Now, the terms of cosmology I was talking about that carry these multiple meanings, oftentimes there are more than two meanings. Oftentimes, there's a whole group of meanings associated with a term. In ancient Egypt, because what the Egyptologists are concerned about is the way a word was spelled with glyphs, not the way it was pronounced, these meanings play out like homonyms of one another, words that are pronounced the same as each other. When you go to ancient Egypt, where you didn't have the kind of societal stability that you have in Egypt, I mean, we go to ancient China, where you didn't have societal stability like you have in Egypt, these terms seem to have been encoded into myths as a way of preserving the groupings of those meanings. And so you find the description of a particular emperor and the things he did, and you discover that his name represents the phonetic value that if you go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, you see all these homonyms that that define the things that emperor did.
Hmm.
So the myth, that makes it look as if certain of these emperors were mythical. They were, these are stories that were made up so as to be able to transmit this cosmological system down through the generations in a public way without the public knowing what they were talking about.
Now, that's very interesting.
Yeah. And so I've seen that in other cultures too. The story of the Exodus from Egypt has all of those same attributes, that the things that Moses is described as doing, the places he goes, the events that happen, all represent a series of cosmological concepts expressed by the same phonetic values. And so Moses looks, on one level, looks mythical. On another level, he actually looks historic.
Hmm. Fascinating. Do you, after doing this research on China, do you think that there is a possibility that there was a universal language in deep prehistory that was able to transcend all the different cultures, so it was a universally understood language, like a science,
yes,
like a mathematics?
Yes and no. And the way to understand what I mean by that is there we ourselves have a pretty universal set of symbols that are used to control traffic in all the different countries. There are universal symbols that mean stop and mean don't turn left and mean, you know, there are multiple meanings of these signs that have been agreed upon internationally to have certain meanings to control the way traffic flows. Well, the ancient languages, the hieroglyphic languages, work that same way, that every symbol represents a concept. And actually, because the concepts associate with more than one meaning, each symbol really represents more than one related concept. And in Egypt, when you string together, in China, it's understood that a glyph represents a concept. That's the way they read their language. In Egypt,
right,
the Egyptologists think that the glyphs were phonetic primarily. But we know from the outset that can't be true because you've only got about 40 phonetic values and you've got 4,000 Egyptian glyphs. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that it wasn't a phonetic language. Okay, so the way I read Egyptian words, the easiest way to illustrate how I read them is with an Egyptian word for week. That word for week is written with two glyphs, a sun glyph, which is a circle with a dot in the middle of it, and it represents the concept of a day. And the other was an upside-down U that is the Egyptian number 10. I look at that word, and what I see is 10 days. And so I went to my sources and did some research and discovered the Egyptians had a 10-day week. So the word defines its own meaning symbolically. Now, when you go to China, if I had had perfect knowledge coming into the China book, I could have demonstrated a positive correlation between the Chinese, ancient Chinese language and the ancient Egyptian language with that one word, because the Chinese word for week is written with two glyphs. the Chinese sun glyph, which was originally round with a dot, and the Chinese number 10. The problem is that in China, there's a myth about an archer who shoots 9 suns out of a tree, leaving a 10th sun. And so the Chinese scholars look at this word and they say, oh, it says 10 suns, because that sun glyph can also represent the concept of a sun. And for some reason, due to what I call academic blindness, none of them notices that this says 10 days, and it defines the 10-day week in China. Both languages work the same way. So a lot of what I'm researching, when you get to a certain level of knowledge, it's this sort of blindingly obvious reference that for hundreds of years sometimes nobody has picked up on.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What would you say the time frame for a 10-day week in Egypt and China was? Was it deep into prehistory before records, or do they actually chronicle a 10-day week in Egypt and China?
Okay, that's hard to say. The system of timekeeping in Egypt goes back as far as we have written records, and it involved a 360-day year, a three-season month, a 10-day week, a 120-day month, and a number of values like that that are consistent with what the Dogon do and with what the Chinese do. Okay. And there are many other cultures that also had a 360-day year. One of the difficulties that arises, this comes up in my a book on a slightly different subject that I wrote called The Velikovsky Heresies, is that at around 750 BC, something happens, and every culture, widespread cultures from all around the world, who for thousands of years had this system of 360-day year and presumably a 10-day week. The Dogon now have a 5-day week. I guess they decided 10 days was too long to go without a weekend. But cultures from all around the world at the same moment in time suddenly switch from a 360-day year to a 365-day year, and they suddenly add 5 intercalary days to reconcile those two calendars. And my reaction to that is that unless we can point to some global influence that could have induced them all to do that at the same moment, that they must have all been responding to a physical change in the year. Now, supportive of that idea is the fact that every total eclipse of the sun that's happened since that time, we can validate to the place and the day using computer calculations. Not a single total eclipse that happened prior to that time can be validated. So something happened to the motions of the Earth or the Moon or our relationship to the sun that has changed the timing of these eclipses. And it happened around 750 BC.
And 750 BC?
Yep. And my feeling is, okay, there are other things that happened around that same time frame that show that something really big happened. There was a major fluctuation in the magnetic field of the Earth they can't explain. And there was a major change in the rate at which plants absorb ions, so that radiometric dating doesn't work across that boundary. And there was major volcanic activity at that time they can't explain. So something big, like the approach of an astronomic body, close approach, happened that affected either the rotation or revolution or of the Earth or its distance from the sun.
Wow.
You also have major climate change at that time, such that crops that had been grown for thousands of years in China could no longer be cultivated there.
750 BC. Now, that's a date that, I mean, most people talk about 9,500 BC as the global shift, but you're talking about another time period where there appears to be, according to the Chinese, a planetary-wide event that was fairly significant.
Now, the Egyptians tell us that 3 times in their cultural memory, the sun rose where it formerly set. And there are disputes as to what is meant by that phrase, but one thing that might be meant by it is that there was a reversal in the tilt of the axis of the Earth while the rotations kept on the same way it always was, and now suddenly the sun rose in the west instead of the east, and then back again. And that there's evidence to support the possibility of that happening. A lot of the ancient traditions describe an event like that that involves the tipping over of the planet, the falling of the sky.
Amazing. Let's dive into a couple of other areas. You have a complete chapter on the whale field system. It's in China, but also in the Dogon system. Can you tell us what the importance of that is?
Yes, this comes back to fundamental concepts of land management in China and in other cultures. The way they looked at, they conceived of a space on the earth, basically, or the concept of space itself. Okay, it starts with the idea of a civic center in China. According to Walter Fairservice, who was a professor of Vassar College where I went, all of the earliest civic centers in China were designed according to the same plan, and that plan happens to be the same basic plan as a Buddhist stupa. They were aligned to the cardinal points in a certain way, and they basically involved a square inside a circle, inscribed either inside or outside of a circle, and the square was divided into four segments, creating an axis. Now, the problem is that in China, the references are ambiguous. Those four squares might be situated corner to corner to create one larger square. I mean, side to side, so they created one larger square. Or they might have been situated corner to corner to create a kind of a cross, and that configuration actually ends up defining nine squares, not four, because you've got the empty spaces as well as the spaces where the squares are. Now, when you bring that plan down to the level of agriculture, the way that agriculture was implemented by the Dogon and the way the theory plays out in China, academics won't agree that it was actually implemented, even though some regional cultures are known to use it, is that nine square plots of land were laid out on the ground, 8 cubits per side, and that they were arranged in this cross format so that you had 3x3 squares. And the eight outer squares were given to eight families to farm, and the central square became a well that they all shared. And so it was called the well field system because this is the way they organized farming.
Wow.
Now in China, they've got, at least theoretically, and I believe in practice, they had the same system. And so this chapter on the well field system, that system is a significant piece of the cosmology. It bears a relationship to the cosmology. Its design relates to the cosmology. And so the fact that the Chinese have it and that it matches the Dogon system argues that we're looking at the same system.
So that was maybe handed down through whatever prehistoric means to these different people.
According to these cultures, this was deliberately instructed. This is one of the civilizing, the purpose of the civilizing plan, according to the Dogon, was to raise humanity up from the level of hunter-gatherers to farmers. And so the effect of that was they wanted to give us all the different individual skills and pieces we'd need to be able to farm. And that includes calendars to be able to track when the seasons were. And it includes units of measure that we needed to measure things. It included the metallurgy, which we needed to make tools to farm with. It included the concept of seeds that could be planted, cultivated. And so there's a whole sequence of skills here that play out the same in China as they do for the Dogon and as they do in India and in Egypt and other places, that of these supposedly instructed skills that are all aimed at establishing a self-sustaining farming civilization.
And did you discover if or is there a link between feng shui and this wealth field system of preparing the house that would sit on one of these grids and so forth?
Feng shui is not one of the philosophies that I explored in the book because it doesn't have precise parallels in the other traditions I'm looking at. But
okay.
In China, they were very proactive about expanding on this knowledge that they were given. For example, the Book of Changes, the I Ching, or the Book of Change, there must be 1,000 different versions of that book that were written. And numerous other philosophies that were extensions of that evolved over time. And so to do a thorough job of documenting China's ancient philosophies like that, you know, you create volumes and volumes and volumes of information. So I tried to restrict myself to the aspects of ancient Chinese cosmology that positively link with these other cultures.
Very good. Gotcha. Well, you brought up my next topic, which is the I Ching. The Western mind considers it esoteric and an occult study, a frivolous game, if you might say. But in China, it's taken very seriously, and you devote a good portion of your book to the I Ching, and how it parallels Dogon and Egypt culture. Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered and the importance of the I Ching?
Yes. Again, the language is what gets us to what the original concept must have been, because the scholars can't agree on what it meant. The way that words are put together in the cosmology is you have certain predefined phonemes that represent certain concepts. And so the word I Ching combines basically the phoneme E, which sometimes is spelled Y-I, sometimes spelled I, and a phoneme J for the Dogon is J-I.
Mm-hmm.
The I phoneme represents the concept of change in state of something. And the way I can illustrate that is it's the idea of ice melting into water or water turning into water vapor. So properly, the book is not the book of changes, it's the book of change. And we're talking about changes in state, and we're specifically talking about changes that occur in the state of matter right after an act of perception. When a wave is perceived, what transformations happen? The phoneme G represents the concept of vibration, which is one of the byproducts of this act of perception that causes these changes in state. And wrapped up in all of that is also a concept of pivoting or twisting that happens to matter during this, as these fundamental components of matter are raised up. And G also represents that. The Dogon actually diagram it. They give a little drawing of a bar that pivots on a point, a bar with two weights, weights on two ends that pivots on a point, to illustrate what they're talking about when they say pivot. Now, one of the seminal references I work with for China is called The Pivot of the Four Quarters. It was written by an academic person from the University of Chicago called Paul Wheatley, and it's really one of the seminal works about ancient Chinese cities. And he feels this concept of pivoting is so important to the foundation of Egyptian civilization of Chinese civilization, that he named his book with him.
Okay. But the thing that I find unique about the I Ching is that, and no one's been able to explain this to me, is that it taps a higher mind, or some would say the unconscious mind. When you ask a question and you get an answer, the answer is formulated by a part of you, a higher part of you, or a higher mind, and that's the right answer to your question.
Okay,
and
the
reason
for that is that this, when they talk about concepts of creation in this tradition, We're talking about multiple themes of creation. One relates to the formation of matter, one relates to the formation of the universe, and the other relates to biological creation. And a single set of symbols was evolved that simultaneously represent all three of these processes as a way of demonstrating that they are fundamentally similar to one another, that the formation of life is fundamentally similar to the formation of matter. And so that aspect of the I Ching is talking about the biological side of the same these same concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And biological / psychological. It's a concept that relates to communication between this non-material universe and material universe.
So what you're saying is thought creates matter. Is that what
you're
saying?
That's the fundamental premise of string theory, basically, is that perception
right.
creates matter. And that's also at the heart of this cosmology, the idea that a mere act of perception somehow causes a change. Now, what I compare that to is, if you think of television shows before we had cable TV being transmitted as waves from a tower, the mere act of pulling a switch on your TV set turned it into an image. That's how matter works,
mm-hmm.
according to these people. Matter exists in its real state as waves, and it only becomes a perceived image when we look at it.
Okay. Why do the Chinese place such a high value in the I Ching, though, do you think? Because
they
know
it
is a source from the higher levels? Do they have a understanding that this, given using these tools in the I Ching, they can derive the essence of the highest form of consciousness?
Well, yes, this the I Ching is credited to the first creator god of China, a guy named Fuxi. Okay, and in China, traditionally, anything that's older is more revered. And so this is the oldest, and so it's the most revered. That's the simple explanation. But it also taps into fundamental concepts that relate to creation and biology, and they're correct in thinking that. And so it's worth pursuing. But like everything else in China, those original concepts have been taken in every possible direction you can conceive of, thousands of different books written and thousands of different outlooks on what the thing really means. And so my goal has been to try to get back to the foundation of it.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, we're getting down to our final few minutes here. If you had a goal in mind, 3 points, let's just say 3 points of reference, what would you want the reader to get from your book, China's Cosmological Prehistory? What did you discover that you would like to convey to the reader?
I would say that the three most important points demonstrated by the book are: it's one more demonstration that all of these ancient creation traditions were fundamentally similar to one another because they came from a common source. That's the first piece. The second piece is that there are fundamental relationships between languages that already cross the boundaries of languages and the boundaries of cultures, that are expressed by these symbols, not so much as a universally designed language necessarily, but as symbols of this creation tradition that were deliberately designed to represent certain concepts. And that that fundamental similarity of language is one of the keys to uncovering this stuff. That's why you have so much emphasis on the word, the word, the word, the word, the word in all of the creation traditions. They're hitting us over the head with the idea of here's where you're going to find it. That's the second piece. The third piece is the inference that because China is so far distant from some of the other cultures that I've been studying, and the traditional researchers don't feel there was historical communication between those groups, that if there was a common source, it didn't come from one of them to the others. It came from a third party to all of them. It's as if you and I had the same math teacher in different eras in high school.
Wow. That's kind of amazing. Fantastic. The book is China's Cosmological Prehistory, the Sophisticated Science Encoded in Civilization's Earliest Symbols, and my guest today has been Laird Scranton. Can you tell us where we can see you? Are you going to be anywhere this summer, end of the summer, this fall?
Yes,
the book's
two
out.
Conferences. There are two conferences being held, one in Minneapolis the first weekend in October. It runs from, I think, the 3rd through the 5th of October, maybe the 2nd through the 5th of October, called the Paradigm Symposium. And if you Google Paradigm Symposium, you'll find references to it. That conference is so populated with interesting speakers that I'm wondering how they're going to have time to do justice to all of them. Everybody you can think of is going to be there, from Eric von Daniken to Graham Hancock to John Anthony West,
yes,
to you name it, they're going to be there. The second conference is a conference called CPAC, the CPAK. It's the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. That's funded by Walter Cruttenden, who founded E-Trade on the Internet. It's going to be in Rancho Mirage, California, the 3rd week of October, from the 17th through the 19th. And it will also be populated with a nice cast of speakers that range from the very academic to the fringe. It's always a very interesting conference.
Fantastic. Well, go ahead.
No, it's okay. Those are the major things happening.
Those
I also have
too.
A book, another book coming out in February called Point of Origin, that ties all of the different cultures that I've been studying together to a common era and a common starting point. And that starting point is conceptually related to Göbekli Tepe.
Ah, fantastic. This has been a great conversation, Laird. Thank you very much. To my listening audience, I strongly urge you to get this book. It's published by Inner Traditions, and it is available on Amazon, and you can also go to Inner Traditions and Bear & Company to get your copy. As a reminder, next week my guest will be Andrew Collins, who will be speaking about Göbekli Tepe. His new book has just come out on Göbekli Tepe, and he will be my guest. So I hope you have a great weekend, and we will hear from you next time.